So welcome everyone to today's Fireside Chat. This is number 415 for CH Networks. We're a project here at the University of Ottawa. Today's date is October 22, 2014. Our topic today is, the next patient is from where in Africa and what am I supposed to do? The initial medical assessment of new immigrant or refugee child.
Hello, welcome everyone. My name is Bob Hilliard. I'm a general pediatrician, and we're actually in the telehealth conference room at the Hospital for Sick Children. I'd like to first give thanks to Agnes Chung Salas, who helped to organize this for us. It's so nice to have it in a formal telehealth conference. So I'm Bob Hilliard, and beside me is...
I'm Andrea Hunter. I'm also a general pediatrician just down the road, usually at McMaster Children's Hospital. Welcome to you all.
And we have nothing to declare in terms of conflicts of interest, although we don't have that slide.
Fine. We'll put our learning objectives on the web for those of you who are interested. But maybe we'll do a little bit of introductions of ourselves a little bit more as we wait for this
Okay. To
come up.
Slide number five.
So again, my name is Bob Hilliard. I'm a general pediatrician. I've worked for many years at SickKids. I also worked to a clinic with the Children's Aid Society. I have 6.5 years background working in East Africa. You will see some pictures of me on that slide, but they go a long way back. My wife and I first went to Kenya 2 weeks after we got married. But I have worked in Kenya, the Congo, Uganda, and Ethiopia. We're going to give you a medical, we're both pediatricians, we're going to give you a medical presentation, but I realize your background may be different. We will try to make sure it's broad enough of interest to everyone. My colleague beside me is?
And I certainly have less experience than Bob and certainly have not lived in East Africa for 6.5 years. Primarily, my work has been in Uganda and Ethiopia and currently running a pediatric residency program in Guyana with my fearless residents there, but mostly in running a refugee clinic, started as a resident advocacy project in 2004 in Hamilton, which I'm very much still involved in, and I appreciate seeing a few of the friendly names of some of our participants who have been involved in that over the years. So we're here really on behalf of a larger group, representing Caring for Kids New to Canada. I hope you've all either been to this website or plan on going there in the near future, or perhaps multitasking as we speak today, where there's a lot more information, and we'll touch on some of these parts today. And this is the second of four webinars by our group on Caring for Kids New to Canada on a variety of topics.
And in this presentation, we have a number of questions for you to answer, and we also have four cases that we hope to discuss.
Yeah. So our first is really to put it over to you, partly to see who's online that hasn't typed in yet, and partly to test out a bit of our technology together. So if you could perhaps answer this slide or this poll by clicking on one of the following, you might have to expand it for yourself, and we'll see who's online here. So. You can only answer once. You may have different hats, but answer for what you do most often. So we'll go on to one more question before we get into some content. So this is just to reflect the next section in terms of content. So with respect to immigration to Canada, which of the following is correct? I know it's not exam time for most of you, but do your best guess.
On slide number 9.
Okay, so most of you had answered that about 25% of newcomers to Canada do not speak either English or French. And in fact, this is the correct statement. So when we include all newcomers, including refugees and immigrants, there's quite a lot more English spoken or English or French spoken. Most immigrants are settling in municipalities or in larger cities such as Toronto, Vancouver, and Montreal. Most are coming from Europe and the UK, previously came from Europe and the UK and now coming from Asia primarily, as well as Indian subcontinent. We'll get into designated country of origin a little later. So we'll move on to slide 10, looking at where in the world newcomers are coming from. These dots represent proportionately the population coming from different parts of the world, and you can see there that although our title that was given to us was primarily around Africa. Most of our newcomers are truly coming from Middle East, Asia, some still in, from Europe, and some from South America. So essentially all over the world. This is all newcomers of all ages, including both refugees and immigrants.
If I could just throw in one thing, Andrea, those are where newcomers to Canada are. If you just consider refugees, where refugees come from depends a lot on the political situations around the world, and the refugees tend to come from other countries such as Hungary, Colombia, Mexico, Sri Lanka, the Congo, or Somalia. So there's a slight difference between all immigrants and just refugees.
Yeah. And of all of these newcomers, a third are children and youth, which is the population that we're speaking about today. In terms of a bit of a taxonomy, for those of you perhaps who are newer to work with newcomers, we look at simply looking, dividing these between refugees, which represent 10% of all newcomers, but probably a disproportionate number of the healthcare provisions that many of us do, or the service provision. And landed immigrants or permanent residents, as they're more formally known. And within those, of course, we've been more aware of the distinction between government-assisted refugees or convention refugees and refugee claimants recently with different federal health cuts. So primarily the federal health cuts have affected the refugee claimants, particularly those from designated countries of origins or DCOs, which are considered safe countries by the recent federal government decision. And if we move on to where those, in sort of the classifications of those, again, you'll see it differently represented, but essentially that number of refugees is staying around that 10% range as things move on, although the number of refugee claimants have unfortunately fallen recently.
So the question that is open-ended really to you to think about, but for time purposes, why is the health of our newcomer children an important issue for you? And you might want to type in some answers, but for time's sake, I'm going to give you my answers. And my answers are that many of the newcomers that come to Canada are families that live in poverty. They are families that have troubles finding employment or housing. Many of the families have difficulty adjusting to our new cities. And many of the families are isolated with very few family supports of grandmothers, aunts, and uncles, and very few family supports to give advice. So if there are health problems, they are just complicated because of the families living in poverty and without a lot of family supports. I think it's also, the topic is also important because children bring new diseases or have chronic diseases which haven't been managed. So they may be diseases that are new to practitioners in Canada or chronic diseases that have been not appropriately managed. I think this topic is also important because many of the refugee families in particular have experienced war or torture or deprivation, and this adds a lot to the family's stress, and dealing with illness just makes it even more stressful to them. And then finally, I think this topic is awfully important because many newcomers do not understand or our explanations of disease and also don't understand our health system and social system. And so we feel that this is a very important topic to consider. So anytime you see a family, it's important to remember that they have come from a long way away. They've had a lot of difficulty getting to Canada. And I greet children and families in English or however I can, but I'm always sensitive to their family dynamics. In many countries, it's the father who is the responsible person, the patriarch in the family, and I'm always sensitive of making sure I address the father as the patriarch of the family, but recognizing that mother knows more of the answers. So I think you have to be aware of family dynamics. I think we also have to understand that our understanding of illness is maybe different than ours. And we talk a lot in North America about viruses and bacteria and autoimmune and allergies, but these may not be familiar terms to many new immigrants and refugees. Also, we need to recognize that many of our questions may to them seem rather strange or inappropriate. We need to recognize what their background might be and that it might have involved a lot of death, violence, hunger, or imprisonment. And then finally, I think we do know a little bit about children from different parts of the world, but be very careful about making assumptions or generalizations about what children might be like.
Perhaps, Bob, just before we go on to the next question, we can just highlight that there was, in fact, the webinar prior to this, approximately a month ago, by Jun Vo and Maureen Mayhew, was around cultural communication with families, and certainly provides a lot more information than we'll go through today.
So a question for you, which is question number 4 on slide 16. What do you do in your practice or your experience or whatever your setting is if you're seeing a child where there's an issue with respect to language and them not being able to speak English?
You can select more than one answer.
You can have more than one answer here.
We're on slide 16 here.
And I like your answers because we try not to, and we discourage using younger children or youth to translate for their parents. It's embarrassing for them and awkward for them. And we really strongly suggest using an in-person qualified interpreter. So we'll go on to the next slide. So we feel very strongly that if you can, to use a trained cultural interpreter. I've worked at the hospital for sick children many years, and this is what we tend to do here. We organize it through Access Alliance Community Health Center. If not, there is a language line that can be used as well. I've done this a lot. I always make sure I look at the parent or the child and talk to them, even though they may not understand me. It's important to have a triangular sitting so that the family can also look to the interpreter. And I must admit, I find that many times they do look to the interpreter. I realize that this takes more time than the general history that we might do with the child. I always ask simple questions, short answers. I avoid jargon and idioms, and I ask my question, pause, and let the interpreter to ask it to the family and then get the answers back. I always make sure I only ask one question at a time. Next slide. I'll do.
Slide 18.
So again, we discourage using younger children. It's embarrassing for them to have to ask about their question, although occasionally for very simple things that may be done. So question number 5. This is a single best answer. Asma is a 4-year-old Somali girl who has immigrated to Canada as a government-assisted refugee from a refugee camp in Kenya. Prior to coming to Canada, she would have had which of the following Labrador tests? A 4-year-old Somali girl from refugee in Kenya.
Your choices are chest x-ray, serology, your analysis, all the above, none of the above. Choose one.
So we're teasing a little bit. Next slide.
Slide 19.
So what has been done prior to Canada, coming to Canada?
So we put this in because this is a common myth amongst health providers, amongst families, also amongst other providers that meet families upon arrival in Canada, and has been a little bit confused by the federal government messaging recently. The immigration medical exam is done, a medical examination and test at the discretion of a medical examiner in the region, not necessarily the country of origin, within a year of arrival. It includes much less than most people think. So in fact, this 4-year-old girl who is a government-assisted refugee from Somalia would have likely had her immigration medical examination done by a provider in Somalia or Kenya. And because she was under 5, she in fact would have none of the above done. So only over 5, a year analysis is done, presumably for hematuria for schistosomiasis, although that's not reliable by itself. A chest x-ray, if you're cumulatively, if you're over 11, you would have a chest x-ray and a urinalysis done, and over 15, serology for syphilis is added. HIV serology in the last number of years has been added to the list, taken away from the list, added back to the list on a number of occasions, which continues to change. So, in fact, previously on the Citizenship and Immigration website, in fact, it was listed that the immigration medical examination is done for immigration purposes only, not a confirmation of overall good health, does not include anything about development, immunizations, or other important parts of a pediatric history or assessment.
Slide 21.
So we're on to the initial medical assessment of an immigrant or refugee child. And this is really no different than what I do with my children from Toronto or from Barrie or wherever. We do a history, we do a physical, we do the appropriate laboratory tests. But again, you need to take a little bit more time in doing your initial interview. It takes more time with, particularly if it involves an interpreter. I've listed on here all the general things that we do, which is generally a very good history and a very good physical examination. And the slide records them there. I want to just highlight two things. One is immunization records. Often children who come from other countries do not know if they've ever had any immunizations. They may have a little card, and we'll get to that later depending on what you do with the card. But we do an overall good history and physical. The other thing, which is down at the bottom, I think it's awfully important to get a sense for where they come from, where their travels have been, and what kind of situations they have gone through. Again, I've highlighted here, don't make any generalizations or assumptions about, well, all Somalis are like this, or all Tamils from Sri Lanka are like this, but get a good sense from where they have come from and what their background has been. Again, it's important to get a psychosocial history. And remembering that people come to Canada for a better life for themselves and their children. They want what is best for their children. They haven't come to Canada to get better medical care or the enjoyment of economics. They want a better life for themselves and for their children and families. We need to be sensitive to the troubles that they have had in the past. And we need to recognize that along with medical problems, there may be some psychosocial problems such as reactive attachment disorders, PTSD, or other kind of psychosocial problems. I'm watching our time carefully. On slide number 24, I do a good physical exam, and I think it's awfully important to do a very thorough physical exam of children, no matter where they come from, and that's listed there. A couple of things. Some children may have had a BCG and there may be a scar, and sometimes this is on a shoulder, much like our smallpox, sometimes on the thigh, or I've even seen some on the forearm. The very bottom one there is to be aware of any marks or scars that have maybe the result of traditional healing or cultural markings. When I worked in Kenya and the Congo, many children would get their traditional treatment as well as come to the medical treatment, and this might include scarifications or marks. And we have a few pictures in just a minute. In fact, here it is. If you see this young man has some scars that are on the epigastrium, and it might have been due to some abdominal pain. I found that scars on the left upper quadrant are usually associated with a big spleen or chronic malaria. Went too fast. There it is again, scars on the left upper quadrant, and that person probably has had sometime malaria or some illnesses associated with splenomegaly or splenic discomfort. So marks that may appear to be child abuse but are often traditional treatments. Sometimes it's called coining because they may use a coin or some other material that makes some bruising or other scars. So these look like they may be child abuse, but in fact, it's traditional treatment. Somebody asked about tribal markings, and there used to be tribal markings in many parts of the world. I don't see as many now as our countries are getting more modern and fewer tribal markings.
So as a general question to those of you who have ability to text answer, we'll do this quickly, but essentially what screening tests or investigations, now knowing what the immigration medical examination includes and what it does not include, which screening tests or investigations, if you want to just type in a few answers of things that you would do for all newcomer children, recognizing that we haven't given you a specific case to look at this yet. We are now on slide 29. So essentially, our answer is that appropriate and clinically relevant tests should be answered or should be ordered. This may be very different between a refugee versus an immigrant child. Some of the things to consider would be a TB skin test, which we'll talk about in a minute, chest x-rays for is required by the immigration medical exam for children over 11. My experience personally is that this isn't always necessarily documented or available to you as a practitioner upon their arrival, and therefore you may need to repeat this, unfortunately. Looking at eosinophil count as well as the rest of CBC for anemia and platelets is important. Hemoglobin electrophoresis, there's a lot of information on Caring for Kids New to Canada website around the hereditary hemoglobinopathies or hereditary anemias, including G6PD and in whom those should be done and so on. A malaria smear, certainly if someone is febrile or symptomatic in some other way and from an area where this is endemic or if you are unsure. And then looking at serology, I think of much of this as thinking about what would be done in a pregnant woman in Canada as part of routine antenatal screening, and therefore what would this infant be tested for that they've essentially perhaps missed out on, and therefore we need to do a bit of catch up as they arrive in Canada at a later age, and therefore syphilis, HIV, Hep B and C, thinking about liver enzymes and thyroid functions as well. A urinalysis, I'm mostly looking for hematuria. If they happen to have active or somewhat recent schistosomiasis, but also protein and glucose for general health. Stools for culture and sensitivity may be less relevant, but ova and parasites certainly very relevant. This is a summary of the similar issues where we look at common things to be done, knowing that stool for ONP sensitivity increases when you do two or three samples on separate days, and also thinking about immunizations, dental, hearing, and vision. And then as indicated for certain populations, those on the right. Again, this is reflecting really that the health issues in refugee children are the same ones that are in any children in Canada. Those in refugees particularly, we often focus on infectious causes. These are the ones that often my learners highlight quite quickly when we talk about newcomer children. And we also have to recognize that there's a number of non-infectious causes of health issues. So iron deficiency is extremely common, as is malnutrition, failure to thrive, dental caries, but also thinking about things like rheumatic heart disease if there's a newly identified murmur or essentially a murmur you identify on a first visit. And mental health and school adjustment concerns also feature very prominently in all of our work. To highlight the medical literature around this, this really is highlighting
slide 33
that amongst a number of studies, this is certainly not a systematic review, but amongst a number of studies with different populations, the values or the prevalence of each of these conditions is quite variable. I'll highlight for you that essentially anemia is very common, particularly in East African children. Lead levels above the threshold would be quite common, again, in this study in Cuban children, but amongst other populations as well. Intestinal parasites are remarkably common and often asymptomatic or symptomatic only with short, with slowed growth, which may not be picked up right away, and TB in terms of latent TB would also be very common. So our initial assessment should really, just to summarize, we know that not all of this assessment can be done in one day. Two or three visits may be needed. A developmental assessment is key, and again, often done a little bit by observation initially and then more formal testing perhaps later. Considering ethnic or genetic medical issues, so those related to the region of origin as well as to the family history in terms of autosomal recessive traits, mental health issues, and then some ongoing anticipatory guidance. So we finally move on to some cases.
So we've done this very quickly, but we want to get you involved with some case discussions, and we have four cases, so let's watch our time for four cases.
So in Simba is a 3-year-old boy who comes to medical walk-in clinic in Etobicoke with a high fever and vomiting. He was born in Kenya, family are Somali refugees, arrived in Toronto 2 weeks ago. He has a fever in the last 2 days. They've given some acetaminophen, but of course it hasn't helped, and he now has vomiting, unable to keep clear fluids down. He's febrile at 40.1, looks pale, toxic, with little interaction with the clinic staff.
So Andrea, if I were the doctor, I worry about illnesses that would I'm so used to seeing. With those kind of symptoms, I would worry about meningitis. I would worry about, you know, a respiratory infection or pneumonia, or even a urinary tract infection. But they're from Kenya, and they're Somali refugees. Oh, I don't know what to do. Have they got Ebola, or is there something else from Africa that I should know about?
So We had a few requests to talk about Ebola today. Really, it wasn't part of our initial plan, and certainly I think I myself along with a number of colleagues have certainly done a lot of educating recently around world geography, that Kenya is certainly thousands of miles or at least kilometers away from West Africa where the Ebola crisis is unfortunately unfolding. And many of you are typing in here malaria, and you are exactly right, that this is really to highlight as our first point in terms of cases that any child with a fever, or really any adult with a fever who's recently arrived from Africa or Asia or those places endemic with malaria, including parts of the Caribbean and South America, should be malaria, malaria, malaria until proven otherwise, and then looking for other causes of fever, both tropical as well as non-tropical. This child is just as likely to have bacteremia, meningitis, acute otitis media, or any other garden variety infection that a Canadian child would have. So in terms of malaria, we need a blood smear for malaria, both the type of malaria as well as the parasitemia. We need a hemoglobin count, as we are aware of anemia being concomitant with malaria. We look at glucose for hypoglycemia, both with falciparum as well as with treatment, as well as renal function tests and liver enzymes. We know that if we overlap the areas of malaria transmission in the world with the areas that our newcomers are arriving from, there is a lot of overlap there. Sub-Saharan Africa is awash with malaria, particularly falciparum, along with some Vivax Novali, as well as Asia and India. It's up there quite readily. So malaria, the Plasmodium falciparum certainly is the most severe form, usually presents within a few weeks of arrival, but can be up to 3 to 6 months. And if suspected, this is considered a medical emergency. And really, this form should be in children should require hospitalization in Canada, although that's not the norm in many other parts of the world. There are other malaria species, Vivax, Ovale, malariae, and also Nolzii. And Vivax Novali can certainly have liver stages and therefore can recrudesce and occur much longer after someone's arrived than falciparum would. So we need those thick and thin blood smears. Rapid tests are now available in most centers and are often used as confirmation of the microscopy or the thin and thick smears that are done. But also please remember to do a blood culture and your usual workup as you're awaiting your malaria smears. So a fever in a child returning from an endemic region of malaria until proven otherwise, as most of you have identified very well. And again, this is really to summarize that we have falciparum, Vivax, Ovale, malaria, Nolzii, and in different parts of the world. Canada, most of ours are imported infections. These do not need isolation, as I've sometimes been asked in my own hospital. And often malaria is unrecognized or delayed diagnosis in Canada if we fail to ask a travel history. Hopefully this practice is increasing in terms of asking a travel history now that we are worried about Ebola, unfortunately. The clinical presentation of malaria in children is really a bit more variable than in adults. We can't diagnose malaria clinically, I think, is the bottom line. It can present with fever, sometimes recurrent fevers, but that's not often seen in children. That classic every 3 to 4 days that's seen in adults. Nausea, vomiting feature prominently, anemia as well as thrombocytopenia, usually more mild than seen in ITP. Splenomegaly, especially with recurrent infections, but also headache and non-specific features feature prominently. So our management really should include a malaria expert, and therefore calling your local infectious disease or tropical medicine expert, whether they be adult or pediatric experience, I think would be warranted in most centers in Canada. We do advise admitting to hospital any child with falciparum malaria and anyone else with a parasitemia more than 1% for other types. Remembering that antimalarials traditionally included IV quinine for more severe infections and now include IV artesunate or in more mild types, Malarone or mefloquine given orally or a coartem or double artesunate variety given orally. Some may need a transfusion or even exchange transfusion if cerebral malaria is present or if a parasitemia is greater than 10%. And remembering that those with liver stages, so both Vivax and Ovale, have risk of recurrence or recrudescence, and therefore they need both the blood stages being treated with the above medications, but also a liver stage treatment with something like primaquine, which we need to test for G6PD deficiency before using this, and that needs to be documented before we give it. We know that those visiting friends and relatives are often known as VFRs are at the highest risk of malaria with their travel, and therefore prevention both in terms of our Our pre-travel advice as practitioners should be that of using mosquito netting treated with permethrin for sleeping from dusk to dawn as they bite these Anopheles mosquitoes, bite from dusk to dawn. Using insect repellent containing DEET even in young children is still advised, and using prophylactic medications. Chloroquine has widespread resistance and really should not be used in most parts of the world, and therefore choosing between mefloquine, malarone, fansidar, or doxycycline or other choices.
So moving on, we're now on slide 44, case 2. Zuzi is a 6-month-old born of a mother who has recently arrived from the Congo. The family came when she was 7 months pregnant, so she had no routine prenatal care. She didn't have any health coverage, so Zuzi was born at home with a midwife. For the past 2 weeks in this 6-month-old girl, she's not feeding well, coughs, low-grade fever, she's underweight, febrile, tachypneic, some fine crackles, she has enlarged liver and spleen, and large cervical lymph nodes. What's the possible diagnosis for Nzuzi, and what should we do? And Andrea, what are you going to do?
This is very challenging. I think any of our pediatric residents, and certainly myself and my colleagues, would scratch our head and say that this child has a long differential of many infectious diseases. The enlarged liver and spleen do point me towards more unusual conditions rather than a typical respiratory infection, and therefore we have to wonder about immunocompromise here.
So some of the thoughts are, could this child have tuberculosis? But overwhelmingly, I think the story seems to be that of HIV/AIDS. Most patients here in Toronto in our HIV/AIDS clinic are newcomer children from different parts of the world. The infections are almost all maternal fetal infections from a mother or originally from the father from an area where HIV is endemic. So I think it's important to know the areas they come from and also to know what areas of the world have HIV. Blood transfusions are unlikely now. In older kids, and Zuzi isn't an older child, we do have to remember that they may have sexual contact. But clinically, they're usually kids of a known HIV mother, and nowadays most newborn areas are screening mothers for HIV serology. But and in Zuzi, they have recurrent respiratory infections and PCP pneumonia. Other clinical features are failing to thrive, chronic diarrhea, hepatosplenomegaly, lymphadenopathy. The later neurologic signs are less commonly now seen with treatment, and some of the malignancies that I saw in Uganda and Kenya of Kaposi sarcoma are really rare in Canada. On slide number 48, for Nzuzi, you would certainly want to do an HIV serology, getting a CD4, CD8 count, but looking for specific infections that may be associated with HIVs, such as PCP pneumonia, TB viruses, or fungus. I'm a general pediatrician. I would never try to treat Nzuzi. I would refer Nzuzi to an infectious disease clinic with an HIV specialist. I do, though, need to be aware of what drugs are used and need to know what I can do in managing along with the ID specialist, such as using immunizations. But I think this little girl needs to be referred to an HIV specialist. However, if you go back to my question, was what is the other thing? And we're going to go back just to the presentation. What is the real challenge in this scenario of diagnosing Nzuzi? It's not just Nzuzi. It's Nzuzi's family. Mm-hmm. Nzuzi has HIV and it's clear, but where did Nzuzi get it from? Nzuzi got it from her mother. And her mother may or may not be aware that she has it as well. And if they're coming from the Congo, you need to know it. Different situations of the Congo. And in the eastern part of the Congo, particularly in the eastern part, there's a lot of sexual violence of women that are part of the treatment of women in that area. And maybe Nzuzi's mother was raped or sexually assaulted in her country. And the diagnosis is not only, the challenge is not only dealing with Nzuzi, but helping the family and the mother with this situation as well. Moving on.
So we'll ask you yet another question to see if people are still online and interested in participating. I'll read it first and then we can have the pop-up screen come up. Nkongo is a 9-year-old boy who's come to Canada in the last 3 months from the DR Congo. He has a cough for the past 3 weeks, afebrile, heightened weight are at the 25th percentile. He has some wheezes and crackles, but really otherwise looks quite well. And on your initial investigations, you note that his hemoglobin is slightly low at 115, his white cell count is slightly elevated at 15, neutrophils are 5, lymphocytes 6, eosinophils are 4, normal would be less than 0.5. And what's the most likely diagnosis for the cause of Nkongo's cough?
So a poll, please, Doc.
There you go.
It up so we can see all of those. It's a lot of information to process. I can see that a lot of you are worried about TB, and we've just spoken about HIV. I certainly would understand your concern. I can't see beyond answer B.
Can you open it further on your screen?
There we go. Okay, so some of you are worried about pneumococcal pneumonia, some of you worried about schisto, one of you worried about HIV, and we'll just give you a few more seconds here for a few more of you to answer. Thank you for your participation. Okay, so the majority of you are worried about TB.
So I'm going to answer this for Andrea, because this is my son when we returned home from the Congo. My son was well and healthy. He didn't look sick. He's afebrile, pneumonia, pneumococcal pneumonia, unlikely. HIV AIDS is unlikely in a child who's growing well and otherwise looks healthy. Without the chronic cough, tuberculosis is really not likely. But the startling thing is the eosinophil count of 4.0, which is higher than you get with asthma or allergies, but is the kind of high eosinophil count that you get when there is a parasitic infection that's systemic kind of infection. And this is not an uncommon story, and my poor son, young Michael, had schistosomiasis that he picked up from the Congo. So the correct answer is actually schistosomiasis, but I think all of these need to be thought about and at least considered.
Great, thank you.
Moving on,
so
case three.
Case three, Amara is a 5-year-old girl whose family's immigrated to Canada from Ethiopia. Their family doctor has referred Amara to the community pediatrician because her initial test indicated a TB skin test of 5 millimeters in duration. Bob, do you see these types of questions in your clinic?
Oh, Andrea, I was told that a positive skin test is 10 millimeters, so I don't know what to do. I wondered whether BCG plays a role in this. I don't know. I would refer it to a pediatrician.
Isn't that what we are? So this is often a common question that we get. I'm going to ask you a little bit more about TB, and then we'll come to what the list of what to do with 0 to 4 and 5 to 9 and 10 millimeters and beyond. So asking you to pull one more time, recognizing TB in newcomer children is important as they're a source of most TB in Canada. Which of the following about immigrant and refugee children is correct? We need to know about their BCG. They live in homes with active TB and they'll be more likely to develop latent TB infection. All of them should have a chest x-ray. 5 millimeters is not significant, or a sickle cell and thalassemia are at higher risk. All right. A little bit all over the map, but it seems the majority like A. So this is also a very common issue that we come across, and in fact, the BCG should not be included in our interpretation of a TB skin test. So we'll move on and appreciate your input. So TB in children, we know that it's most common in families from endemic areas as well as our Indigenous population in Canada, but two-thirds of the TB in children is from children born outside of Canada. They're, of course, much higher at risk if they're HIV positive, and mostly they have respiratory symptoms, although in children, TB meningitis, osteo-abdominal, or disseminated TB are certainly not rare. Diagnosis can be suggested by a TB skin test, but really diagnosis would come from a chest x-ray suggesting some pulmonary involvement and then either bronchial alveolar lavage or induced sputum, which can only be done in older children, usually over 6, and therefore we rely on gastric washings or an NG placed for acid-fast bacilli and testing of early morning gastric aspirates in young children, usually for 2 to 3 days in a row. The management would include 3 or 4 drugs if it's actually active pulmonary TB or disseminated TB, and again, this is when I defer to my TB or ID specialist, depending on culture and sensitivities, which is why it's important to either have an induced sputum alveolar lavage or gastric aspirates. Usually our treatment is for 6 to 12 months, although for prophylaxis, we typically still use INH for 9 months. Okay. And why the alarm in newcomer children? Most of the TB, as we've said, is in newcomer children. TB resistance is increasing, both INH and multi-drug resistance. And here's your answer. Those 20 to 50% of children living in homes with active TB will develop latent TB infection. Again, it's inversely related to age. The younger they are, the more likely they are to develop a latent TB infection that would require INH for 9 months. And they are at high risk of activation to TB disease, again, inversely proportionate with their age, and therefore very important to pick up these kids ideally early upon arrival in Canada. So who should we screen? Who should we screen? We should screen those who are contacts of a known case of active TB. We should screen, we're on slide 53, so we're attempting to be. Children with suspected active TB disease, children with known risk factors for progression, so immunosuppression or otherwise, or being immunosuppressed, for instance, for IBD treatment with biologic agents. Children who have traveled or resided for greater than 3 months in an area with high endemicity, this would include Bob's children, I suppose, earlier in their life, and children who are less than 15 years of age who arrived in Canada in the last 2 years from countries with a high TB incidence. Again, that's reflecting not that adults are at no risk, but that they're at lower risk than younger children. So finally, we come to what are our criteria for a positive TST. This brings us back to Amara, who's a 4-year-old who has a 5-millimeter TB skin test. And essentially, because she has a positive TB skin test and is from an area of endemicity, this would be considered positive in her. In someone without risk factors, more than 10 millimeters would be considered positive. Okay, so essentially in summary, TB is an important pathogen worldwide, but also locally here in Canada, especially amongst our Indigenous population or our newcomers. We should be screening all at risk. There is some controversy, particularly in the U.S., around TB skin tests versus IGRAs or serology testing that's been mostly available in research areas and increasingly in some tertiary care centers, but not widely available, and therefore we're still depending on TSTs. We should consider a chest x-ray if there's a TST that's positive or indeterminate, and a referral if there's any signs of latent TB infection or TB disease. And the definition of the positive skin test differs based on the risk and the age of the child, but not on their BCG status. It should be interpreted by yourselves, trained interpreters, or trained healthcare providers, not by the family or self-report.
So that does mean to be careful when you do it and not do it on a Thursday or Friday so
exactly.
That it would be read on a weekend date.
This is quite challenging, and I, in fact, from a practical standpoint, do find that I try to do these every opportunity I can, including in the emergency department if I'm sending a child home with follow-up or in inpatient environment, because catching them 48 to 72 hours later in clinic environments can sometimes be challenging. So the increased risk of lifetime progression to disease, the current recommendation is to treat latent TB infection for 9 months. Treatment of TB disease certainly requires some expert input, and we need to notify our public health colleagues and authorities in either case.
As an audience, you've been very good with us. We're going to go a little over the 2 o'clock time. We originally wanted to do this for an hour and a half, but it was listed as 2. If you do leave, we won't feel badly about it, but we are going to go a little over time. Question number 9 is about immunization. Ahmed is a 4-year-old boy originally from Afghanistan who has come to Canada from a UNHCR refugee camp in Pakistan. When they come to see you in their office, the father gives you a card written in Urdu with numbers 2, 4, and 6, and the rest of it is in Urdu. Ahmed has had some needles and some medicine in the camp, but they really don't know what they've had. What are you going to do for Ahmed? There are 5 choices here.
Slide number 57.
So we have a lot of answers D, which is essentially assume he's not received any and start all over again. Many want to translate that card that he's showing you into English, which seems very reasonable. And someone wants to do serology, also quite an interesting option. So really, we know that the immunized, so most of you wanted to repeat those and some wanted to translate the card. We know that there's quite a significant difference between the World Health Organization Expanded Program on Immunizations, or WHO EPI program, and the Canadian guidelines that you see there on the right. Our Canadian series has a lot more immunizations than the WHO, and therefore, really, we suggest a catch-up immunization schedule for newcomer children with either missing or uncertain records. Now, this card that is not translated into English could be considered uncertain. If you can have it translated, that's fine. There are some other things to consider, however. Some of these cards may be somewhat suspect information, either because there's a value in someone creating a good immunization record, perhaps for an internationally adopted child, or there may be concerns about the cold chain or the validity of those vaccines, depending on where they were given. If they were given by a large NGO, such as MSF, in a refugee camp, they're probably quite valid. But again, we're always a little bit unsure. We can do serology, but often the practice is to start all over again. And that's just because follow-up visits for serology and the cost of doing those and having children come back and knowing how to interpret those is often quite challenging. Each province essentially has their own catch-up schedule. Usually it varies by age. For instance, in Ontario, under 1-year-old, between 1 and 7, over 7 up to an adult, have different catch-up schedules and are quite clear. And we would be happy to provide more information about those to anyone who's interested by email afterwards.
Here's an open-ended question. Carlo is a 6-year-old boy who's come to Canada from Colombia in the past 6 months, presently in grade 1. He's in an ESL class. His report card that says he's not doing well academically, he's unable to read or recognize letters, but he's very hyperactive, gets into fights with the other children. What are the next things that you would do for Carlo? Arrange for an audiogram, get more history about family dynamics and family stress, request an urgent psychoeducational assessment, start a trial of stimulant medication, request an urgent psychiatry assessment. And although it's a single choice, all of these need to be considered. Okay. The answer we really wanted is that I think you need more history about the family dynamics and family stress. However, an audiogram is also important to do as well. So let me give you another case, and again, please be patient with us. A child that I saw a number of years ago was an 8-year-old girl attending a local Catholic school, referred to me because of difficulties in her schoolwork. Maria lived with her mother and her 5-year-old brother in junior kindergarten. The family left Colombia 3 years ago because of the political fighting. The father is still in Colombia, and the family haven't heard from him for the past 9 months. She's having problems learning to read, problems paying attention. She needs a lot of supervision to get her work done. Sometimes she can be disruptive in class, picking fights with the teacher. And Maria's mother has difficulty with English. She's attending an adult learning class for English. She works part-time in a donut shop. I don't say which donut shop. And what do we do with Maria here, who's having difficulties in school? What are the possible diagnoses? You can write them in here, but I will move on if I can. My role as a pediatrician is to look for medical diagnosis. And so with Maria, I want to make sure that she doesn't have any medical diagnosis. And here's where I think a hearing test is needed. Things like seizures are unlikely. My other role as a pediatrician with Maria and her mother is to advocate for Maria to the school. And I always write letters, and with parents' permission, I will phone the family as well. And my other role is to help the family understand Maria's school difficulties. I'm looking at the problems. Anthony phoned to ask about getting eyes tested, and Anthony, you're right as well, as you always are, correct. We are being a little simplistic, easily. Whenever I see kids, I wonder if it's a problem in the school, the home, or with the child. And Maria could have some learning difficulties or problem with her overall intellectual abilities. She could have ADHD or behavioral problems. I also need to do a good history and physical to find out if there are any other medical problems with Maria. I have to be aware that there may be issues at school that account for her school difficulties, either in the school program or school attendance, or bullying with other children at the school. And then finally, I have to be aware, is there some problem at home? And there are issues such as mother not speaking English, mother not knowing about the school system, mother not always being at home with the children, and also problems with poverty in the home. So I think with Maria, we need more history about what's going on with Maria and the family in the home situation. What can be done? We can deal with specific medical problems if appropriate, and I really stress if appropriate, a stimulant medication. Sometimes special help can be given at home or in the classroom setting, but also help with the family with family and social issues. I think a lot of new immigrant children and families have troubles with school. I think sometimes it's because of the lack of difficulty with English or French. Sometimes it's because the parents can't help their children with their homework. Sometimes the parents may not be able to attend meetings with the teachers. They may be working, and many fathers or mothers are doing two or three different jobs to make enough money. Parents also don't understand our school system, and this is where I think we as health professionals need to advocate for children. And there may have been problems with the family in terms of family separation or problems. And with Maria's case, father is in Colombia. They didn't know whether father was still alive or whether he might have been killed in the area of Colombia that they were living in. And there were a lot of concerns about the father and where he was. And then finally, I think you have to say that children may have learning difficulties that go unrecognized and not well managed. But I've got this at the bottom of the list. I think you have to think of all of the social situations ahead of that.
So we will wrap up knowing that there's been some questions sort of scrolling through that we'll try to answer as well. But we know that our newcomer children are a diverse and growing population in Canada. We would like you to, in addition to your excellent general pediatric assessment, consider the nutritional, climate, housing, school, family adjustment and challenges, as well as those infectious diseases that often come to mind as our typical tropical diseases in some newcomers. We want you to look at the exposure to trauma and the mental health implications, which are really quite significant and sometimes quite challenging for health care providers to address, but seek out some assistance from many of our support services. We know that the barriers to optimal health care are numerous, but we can advocate for change, as many of us have been recently. And we hope that you enjoy the rewarding interactions with these newcomer families and the learning that we can do from them or with them, as we have. We also want to perhaps end on a positive note in that we all know about the healthy migrant effect, knowing that newcomers to Canada or to any high-income country, in fact, typically arrive as healthier than our Canadian population in terms of of cardiac disease, obesity, diabetes, and so on as they get older, and in fact, as they adopt our lifestyle, sometimes become less healthy. And so we want to recognize that although refugee children often have some acute medical needs, really we, most of our children and newcomer families are healthier than the Canadian population and quite resilient. So for those of you who have many, many more questions from today, there's a lot more information on Caring for Kids New to Canada website that Bob and I certainly can't take credit for, and it's a large editorial board that's contributed here. And we look forward to some discussion time now, either by text or in person, or any questions to each of us by email, if you prefer.
If I could, Andrea, scrolling through, I remember seeing some questions, and Dot can help me, others. I think Tracy asked a question about confidentiality with respect to the interpreter. And I always, two things. One is when the interpreter comes, the interpreter expresses to the family clearly, everything that you say will be kept confidential and nothing will go outside of this room and this interpretation. The other thing that Tracy asked about, well, what happens if they know each other? And I think I've always asked the family, are you happy with this person using their name? to be your interpreter for this clinic session. And if by any chance the family are not happy with that particular person, they may say, no, I'm not happy with it, and we would reschedule things. So confidentiality is awfully important.
And it seems that Dot has a number of questions to ask. Maybe we'll go to her and then we'll go back to our list.
I have two other questions that I read. Somebody asked about vitamin D, and is that a problem because it wasn't, measuring vitamin D wasn't on the list?
I think it had more to do with the fact that we typically would previously order a 25-hydroxy vitamin D level on newcomers, recognizing it could be low and they're at higher risk of rickets. At least in Ontario, it's been delisted or people need to then pay for it in most outside labs. And therefore, we often use alkaline phosphatase as sort of a poor man's study of significant decrease in vitamin D status, although it's not perfect. But if that's over about 2,000 or so, that would be indicative of rickets. And some of us can do 25-hydroxy vitamin D studies in more specialized areas if needed.
Most of these children come from areas where there's lots of sun.
Yes.
And when I was in Kenya and the Congo, there were no problems with vitamin D deficiency mm-hmm. because of the sun. It's when they come and live in Canada
yes.
in our darkness and are all covered up and kept indoors in the winter that they have problems.
And often in our infants born to moms who have darker skin and are fully covered, that would certainly be an issue. We also have a question about why serology by immigration medical examination was only done over 15 years of age, someone very appropriately pointing out what about child abuse and that, as Bob has written down and I have concluded as well, unfortunately that rule or that guideline was set by the federal government and doesn't necessarily match with what health providers would find clinically relevant, and therefore it's a very good point and perhaps we need to screen them separately. And I think that was really what we wanted to highlight from the fact that the immigration medical examination has many holes and is certainly not comprehensive, and therefore we need to fill in those gaps as clinically relevant. Perhaps, Dot, we can turn to you.
You're hitting most of the questions. Beautifully done. There's a couple questions from Deborah. She's asking, when working with our First Nations, it was stressed that if they had a BCG, no skin test should be done. It will usually create a positive result of any size in duration. So why is it different for immigrants?
Oh, there were a few questions, thank you, about tuberculin skin test. Perhaps, Dot, you can go back to slide 54, I believe it was, where we looked at the criteria for a positive test as we talk. So agreed that there is a lot of challenge around this BCG and how to interpret a TST. The Canadian TB guidelines that I've just reviewed are pretty clear that we shouldn't include whether they've had a BCG or not, and in fact you won't see it listed there. I know that historically people would either say we couldn't ever use it, a TB skin test, or we couldn't at least use it for a year after a BCG. So perhaps in a young infant and you're worried about immunocompromise and you wonder if the TB skin test would react, that may have been where that question came from, but really we ignore the BCG status when we interpret TSTs. There was another question about this child, Amara, having a 5-millimeter TB skin test and how to interpret that. I think I need to clarify that really if this child is suspected of having TB, meaning she's had an active TB contact or she's unwell in any way in terms of both growth or also pulmonary symptoms, then I would interpret that as positive because she had one of those second or third risk factors present. But if not, it would be considered negative. My apologies if that created some confusion. It's only if they are HIV positive and they have a high likelihood of TB infection, meaning in all of our newcomers, essentially, then under 5 millimeters would be considered positive. So it's really somewhat based on your clinical suspicion or your pretest probability, one might say.
Great. Second question from Deborah. We would also not refer to the specialist unless the induration was greater than 10 S per the Canadian guidelines, and why is there a difference?
Right, and I think that certainly addresses it, that in our newcomer children coming from TB endemic areas, we need to be much more highly suspected, especially if there's growth retardation, any pulmonary symptoms, or other infections in the child. Tracy, your question about the use of QuantiFERON or TB gold test really is probably more for a TB expert. I'll and certainly a bit beyond my expertise as a general pediatrician. Really the use of some of the specialized testing for TB that are used in tertiary care centers or in research purposes are not widespread across Canada, or we don't have widespread availability to those, and it would be in the same categories as IGRAs, which in some populations may be helpful, but really not readily available, and therefore why we're not addressing them on this website or this webinar. I think Tracy also had a question about the most effective treatment for low vitamin D. And really, again, I think, Bob, I'm not sure what you're doing. I'm treating with either 1,000 to 2,000 units of vitamin D and considering use of calcium supplementation as well when I'm getting up to those higher supplementation rates.
One other comment. When you were talking about the child who was having difficulty in school, but the schools also may not understand the context of the children's lives.
So, Dot and Jacqueline, I think that's an excellent point. And so I stress what I try to do as a pediatrician when I see children who have school difficulties is that I always write a letter to the school. I give it to the family so they can read it or at least have someone read it for them and then take it to the school. If I have other concerns, I get signed consent from the family to talk to the school. And I think we as healthcare professionals need to advocate for our children. And this involves, I think, talking to, and many schools are really quite happy to have the pediatrician talk to them about the children's situations. And I think you're right, a very busy teacher with 30 kids in her classroom may have great difficulty trying to understand all the problems of all the children that she sees. Can I go back to Andrea's last slide, which was on 69? I've had a wonderful time meeting children from different parts of the world and getting to know them. I always ask where they come from. I try to get to know their different languages, and I try to explain where I've lived and worked. And I think working with immigrant and refugee children are a wonderful way of getting more broad breadth to our professional life and professional work, and it's really been very rewarding to me to work with children and refugees from various parts of the world. Although it's more challenging and it takes more time. It
takes more time.
And more patience.
Yeah. And I think from my personal experience, I think one of the most heartwarming parts of my work is now continuing to follow a number of children that I met first as newcomers in our more typical refugee clinic with a translator who are now happy to come to, as they call it, my proper office on their own without a translator, and continue to follow with me, and that's been quite rewarding as well. Maybe we'll turn it over to Elizabeth if she's still on the line.
And also, if you want to ask us anything further or if you want to make a comment, on the very last slide on 72 are our email addresses at SickKids and at McMaster. Plus, one of the best elephant and cheetah pictures that I took in Kenya.
Elizabeth, do you have some last thoughts you'd like to leave?
Just very quickly, I want to thank Bob and Andrea for a fantastic presentation, and thank everyone for participating. I want to just mention Bob and Andrea referred to the Caring for Kids New to Canada website. They were both are both members of the editorial board that put together the information on that site, so please do visit it. We would love to have your feedback. There are lots of places on the site where you can indicate what you thought of the material and whether there's other material that you would like to see up there. I'd also like to thank our funder for these websites, which is the Canadian Institutes for Health Research, that provided the funding for this webinar series. This is the second of six that we will be doing thanks to CAHR funding and with CAH Network. So look for more promotion. The next one will be coming up on mental health in early December. So thanks very much to everyone. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. If you had one last thought that you'd like to leave with our participants, what would that be?
I think my thought would be to enjoy your work with newcomers. They'll broaden your horizons. We can learn as much from them as we perhaps teach them, and that they are really looking for a good life in Canada, are as likely to have any health conditions that Canadian children have, although some other considerations as well.
It may seem to be challenging to take more time and be more patient with families, but I think the reward that you will get and learn from families, and by providing good health care for the children means that they will become great Canadians as they grow older. And I'm surprised when I look at the University of Toronto or York University to see how many immigrant refugee children are growing up and becoming very successful in Canada as Canadian citizens.